From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. The one-week increase in COVID cases in the U.S. is up by nearly a third. That rise is largely fueled by the Omicron variant, all while Americans scramble to find over-the-counter COVID tests and wonder how to keep their families safe over the holidays. Here's President Biden addressing the country yesterday.
If you are vaccinated and follow the precautions that we all know well, you should feel comfortable celebrating Christmas and the holidays as you planned it. You know, you've done the right thing. You can enjoy the holiday season.
That seems to run counter to comments from the head of the World Health Organization, who said yesterday an event canceled is better than a life canceled. So let's sort all of this out with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's top infectious disease doctor and advisor to President Biden. Dr. Fauci, welcome back and happy holidays.
Thank you, and good same to you.
Let's begin here, because people are confused about what to do over the holidays. We know vaccines can prevent serious illness and death, but not necessarily transmission of Omicron. And earlier this week, Dr. Peter Hotez told us he was not going to have his mother-in-law join his Christmas celebration because he believed being boosted several months ago would not provide adequate protection. So what advice do you give on how to plan for holiday visits?
Well, I think the president said it very clearly, and maybe I could expand on it a bit. What he was saying, that if you are vaccinated and boosted and you are with family members in the home setting where everyone is vaccinated and boosted, although there's no such a thing as 100% risk-free, the risk of there being an issue there is very, very low because of what we know the vaccinations and the boosts can do. So he was saying you should feel comfortable in having a family gathering when you know the vaccine status, particularly if everyone's boosted, that you can have a comfortable, relatively risk-free situation. One of the things that we don't want to get confused at, and I think that's what the WHO was saying, the one thing you want to stay away from are large party-like gatherings where you have a get-together of a big Christmas party with 30, 40, 50 people, many of whom you do not know what the vaccine status is. That is something you should stay away from. But that intimate family gathering of vaccinated people is something that you should not hesitate to do if, in fact, you're vaccinated and boosted.
What if the people in your family need to travel? Dr. William Hazeltine reiterated this morning that taking trains and buses, being in airports, can be a risk. You can't guarantee everyone is vaccinated.
That's true, and that's the reason why when you are in those situations, it is critical that you wear a mask. Whenever you are in an indoor congregate setting, be very compulsive about keeping your mask on. One of the extra things that can be done, and I know it isn't always easily available, but to go the extra mile, as it were, and even when you have a vaccinated and boosted group of people, to get a test, one of those rapid tests that you can get and do either the day of or the day before you meet and congregate with other vaccinated people. It adds an extra level of confidence that everyone is safe. The reason for that is that there have been breakthrough infections, a considerable number, as you might expect, because the vaccines are really geared to prevent clinically recognizable disease and not necessarily infection. So you could have an inadvertent, really undetectable infection. And that's one of the reasons why, if possible, you should also get a test as another layer of protection.
It's not always easy to get your hands on a test, though, is it? The president said yesterday he'll distribute 500 million test kits. These are those rapid antigen tests beginning next month after the holidays.
Right.
But what about the people who need tests now? I mean, I just went into my CVS and could only get one.
Right. Well, there's no doubt we can't run away from the fact that given the demand, particularly the demand with regard to the holiday season and the demand that is amplified because of the issue and the concern about Omicron, is that many people can't not readily get tests. And that's unfortunate. And that's what the president was saying, that we're trying to correct that as rapidly as we possibly can by the numbers that you mentioned, 500 million tests available in January, and also being able to get on a website and order tests free to be delivered to your home. So that is going to change rapidly. Unfortunately, it's not going to change tomorrow.
Yeah. I want to ask you about treatments. We've heard some of the antibody treatments are less effective against Omicron. And then yesterday, the FDA approved a new treatment, Pfizer's Paxlovid. Can you give us more details about treatments?
Yes. I mean, the monoclonal antibodies that we had, and we had a whole panel of them that looked very good against Delta, several of them now have dropped out in that they do not seem to protect against Omicron. There is one, a newer one, Sotrovimab, which is a monoclonal antibody made by GSK and Vir, which looks pretty good even against Omicron. So that's one of the things. But also, there are now small molecule antivirals, such as molnupiravir. The Paxlovid just received, I believe, its EUA today. And there is an already approved drug called remdesivir. So there are small molecule antivirals that are available, and they're used fundamentally to prevent people to go from a symptomatic infection to the requirement of a hospitalization, and they should be given very early within the first 3 days or so from the time that you get recognizable clinical disease. But although some monoclonal antibodies have dropped out, there is one that we know works quite well.
That is the nation's top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, with the latest on the pandemic. Dr. Fauci, as always, thank you so much for joining us, and happy holidays to you.
My pleasure. Good happy holidays to you, too. Thank you very much.
Why do we sleep? That is the question that fueled the work of Alan Rechtschaffen, a sleep researcher who dedicated his career to studying the purpose and function of sleep. Rechtschaffen died last month at the age of 93, and throughout his career, he was fascinated about the impact of sleep deprivation on our health. And he was particularly interested in the rapid eye movements, or REM, we make during sleep. Here he is explaining it in a 2010 interview.
I thought that this was a perfect vehicle for studying that issue because you could conceive of it as the mind turning on with the REM period and turning off with the end of the REM period.
For more than 40 years, Dr. Rechtschaffen was also the director of the University of Chicago Sleep Laboratory. And during that time, he advised many PhD students, including Paul Shaw, who is now professor of neuroscience at Washington University's St. Louis School of Medicine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Alan Rechtschaffen was your advisor during the 1990s. What stands out to you about working with him?
You know, Al was, you mentioned, his primary goal was to discover the function of sleep, and he was passionate about it. He recognized that this was a hard problem, and I would say one of his major contributions to the field was focusing on how one might know how to study anything in particular. We all do experiments, and we expect that those experiments are doing what we want to, but oftentimes there are hidden assumptions, and Al had this great mind. He knew the scientific method, and he knew how to think about complex problems, and he brought that to the whole field.
One of the ways that he taught was by sharing stories, and he shared many stories with you. Is there one that especially resonated with you?
You know, there's so many, and the thing about telling somebody else's stories, it's a little bit complicated. Every time Al told a story, he was educating those of us in the room that were listening to the story. One of my favorite stories was Al was hooking up a human subject to be recorded overnight, and this person was particularly difficult, causing Al and the rest of the team a huge amount of problems. Al got super frustrated, finished hooking the guy up, went back into the control room, and said out loud, "If he doesn't go to sleep right away, I'm going to shock him," in frustration. And apparently the guy went right to sleep because the intercom was on. But that's just kind of his personality. He was playful, he was blunt, and he was to the point.
What impact did he have on you and your research?
You know, I have to say that in many respects, Al was like a second dad to me. He taught me so much about science and how to think clearly. He taught me how to question all of my assumptions. And to this day, I will tackle problems that I probably would never have tackled otherwise. Al knew deep down that the scientific method, if applied properly, could be applied to any question at all. And he fearlessly jumped into the thick of problem sets that no one else would want to study or no one thought could be studied well. And he did it with aplomb.
You know, we've come so far in our understanding of the importance of sleep to our health. How would you describe his contribution to that understanding?
Well, that's a big question. There's a lot of people who have contributed to this field, right? The idea that if you don't get enough sleep, bad things happen. And it's overwhelming, the data that highlights just how important sleep is to health and how not getting enough sleep is detrimental to health. So certainly Al showed in a convincing way that if you don't get to sleep, that you don't live. And he did this in a way that was experimentally sound and that was controlled, and the answer was unmistakable. He didn't have a big ego. His goal was to think deeply and clearly about complex problems and then to solve them. And he was a master at that.
That's Paul Shaw, professor of neuroscience at Washington University at St. Louis's School of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was another tough year for movie theaters as they struggled to attract filmgoers driven away by the pandemic. But whether you dared a theater or stayed at home to watch via streaming, there were a bunch of good movies that came out this year. So joining us to talk about a few of her favorites is Ayesha Harris, co-host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Ayesha, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What kind of year was this for movies?
This year was a really good year for movies, at least in terms of quality. You know, Sundance Film Festival is usually sort of the first big festival to kick off the year. And while it was all online this year because of obviously the pandemic, I think that there were a lot of really strong movies that came out of that. One of my favorites was Summer of Soul that came out of Sundance. And other movies like Coda and Censor were really great. So I think it's been an interesting year for movies, but in terms of theater going, that might be a whole other story.
Yeah, it probably is.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at a few of the films on your list, and let's start with a couple that are in theaters right now that people can go see them if they so dare. That includes one from Oscar-winning filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. His new film is called Nightmare Alley, and it stars Bradley Cooper as a 1940s grifter who teams up with a psychiatrist played by Cate Blanchett. So an incredible cast. Let's take a listen to a snippet of a scene where he's checking out her office.
Microphones.
That's right. Wire recorder.
Are you recording this?
No. My office is wired to record all analysis sessions.
You got a smoother line, but you run a racket. Same as me.
Is that what this is?
So why this one? What do you like about it?
Well, I'm a big noir fan, and so this is based off of a 1947 noir movie of the same name, as well as the book that inspired that movie. And I love seeing noir especially reflected in today's world. And while it's set in the past, I think Guillermo del Toro, he's always a fascinating director to watch, even when I don't necessarily love his movies. I think he has a real knack for horror and this sort of seedy, gory nature of things. And so especially the first, like, 30-ish minutes of this movie or so are set in the carnival world, and to see Bradley Cooper's character and all of these other, you know, carnies in this world, it's very much like you can feel it. Guillermo del Toro is really good at evoking that sort of weirdness, that oddity, and the creepiness of that world. And so it really worked for me overall. And I think also Cate Blanchett is just fantastic. She comes a little bit later into the movie, but she is definitely playing a femme fatale and is doing the most in, like, the best way possible.
It is a very stylish movie. The clips that I've seen so far, it is stylish. Like,
yes,
it's fun to look at. Bradley Cooper, by the way, is also in the next film pick we're going to talk about, which is called Licorice Pizza. That was written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, and there's a lot of buzz generating right now, both for Anderson and the entire cast. Cooper Hoffman stars. That's the son of the late Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then there's Alana Haim, who's best known as a musician in the band Haim with her sisters. So yeah. What do you think about this one?
I really loved this movie, and, you know, I've seen people referring to it as a coming-of-age story, but I don't really think it feels even shaggier than that. There are definitely arcs and moments, but it is very much like a movie that for me is all about the mood more so than it is a, like, real coming-of-age story. I have some caveats that I see people have been mentioning. There's a couple scenes that involve some very racist stereotypes about Asian people, and I don't think the movie is exactly handling it in the best way possible. It's just kind of like a, why is this here? But aside from that, I think it's just a really great mood piece, and I think the performances from everyone in the cast are really, really strong and striking.
So what would you use to describe it? Is it warm? Is it funny? Like, what's the character of this movie?
It's definitely funny, and it has warm moments. It's set, you know, in the 1970s in San Fernando Valley in California. And so it definitely has that sort of nostalgic feel to it, but without being too overly sentimental. I think it's really just like an interesting look at these two characters, these two young characters, and this, you know, their friendship that hinges on, or that like teeters close to romance but isn't quite that. And I just think overall it's like, it's warm, it's funny, it's also just you got to seep into it, you got to just like sit through it and really let it wash over you.
And let's hope that not all of the characters talk like this, like, oh my god. Having grown up not far from the valley, yeah. You also picked a film that came out earlier this year. It's called Shiva Baby, written and directed by Emma Seligman, and stars Rachel Sennett as Danielle, an almost dangerously close to graduation college student who is attending a family Shiva and almost immediately gets cornered by her mom. Her mom's played by Polly Draper, so let's take a listen.
Here.
Oh, Mom, I can't eat that.
Why not?
I'm vegetarian.
You're killing me.
I've told you it so many times.
You have not eaten a single thing all day.
That's because we just got here.
You look like Gwyneth Paltrow on food stamps.
Oh, my God.
And not in a good way.
So, you know what, Anna? So it goes down from there. Tell me a little about this movie.
I really loved this movie. So this movie is about a young woman, like you said, who is like on the cusp of graduating. She doesn't really know what she's going to do with her life. And she just so happens to have both a sugar daddy and a ex sort of friend / occasional lover. And the sugar daddy is played by Danny DeFerrari. And the ex friend / lover is Molly Gordon, played by Molly Gordon. And they both wind up at the Shiva. And so neither of them know about each other. And it's just this like about 90 minutes, a little bit less than 90 minutes of almost all of it takes place in real time, being at this party. And a lot of people will probably be familiar with this feeling of being ready to graduate, having to be around your family friends and around your family and having them all ask you what you're doing or what you're going to do with your life and not knowing. And it's a comedy, but it's also very much a horror movie in many ways too. Like it's like all the small talk that happens at parties that everyone dreads is what is happening here. And it does a really good job of tapping into those things in a funny and terrifying way.
Yeah, there's a lot of awkwardness is the sense that I get.
Yes.
Also on your list is Zola. That was directed and co-written by Janixa Bravo. It's a film that came out in June, and it was supposedly based on a viral Twitter thread. Is that right?
Yeah, it was. It's probably one of the first major Hollywood movies to be based off of a Twitter thread. And it does a really great job of taking that sort of the language of social media. There's a lot of moments where you hear dings. There's a lot of texting. There's a lot of words coming up on the screen. And also just like you'll often hear the whoosh sound like when you send a tweet. Those are all deliberate there. They really bring to life the language of this Twitter thread while also making such a visually stunning movie. And it's got great performances from Taylor Page and Riley Keough, who are playing these women who just met, who one of them is black and one of them is white. They've just met and they are going to go take a road trip to do some dancing at a strip club. And they go to Florida. And anytime you're going to Florida in movies, there's always going to be something going wrong. And this is another movie that's like part comedy and then part horror movie in the best way possible.
There's also one more you wanted to talk about, which is a Japanese film with subtitles, which can sometimes be difficult to sell to a broader audience. But it's called Drive My Car and written and directed by Ryusuke Hamaguchi. What makes this one worth seeing and why do you like it?
Well, I'll be the first one to say that most movies today are too long. And I'll caveat this, but this movie is 3 hours long. But But it didn't feel like 3 hours. It's very much, it's a slow burn. It's an absorption. There's like a 40-minute or so preamble that really sets up the mood of this movie. And it's about this man, this actor who suffers a great tragedy and then goes to take up a residency and direct an experimental version of Uncle Vanya. And he's assigned to this driver, and that's where the Drive My Car comes in. So this driver for his daily commute. And they both get to know each other and we learn about the things that they are dealing with. And to me, like, it has this central question of like how we define love and what that means. And I think it does such a beautiful job of like weaving in all of these elements from both Chekhov and other themes that you might be familiar with in films. And the performances are great, and it's worth the three-hour drive that it takes to go through this whole movie, I promise.
Wow, it's only my respect for you that would make me believe that. We have the full list of your top 10 available on the website, so people can check out your other picks there. But can we look ahead to next year and see what you're anticipating?
Oh, man, I'm still catching up on so many things for this year. But I will have to say that the two things that I'm most excited for are the new Jordan Peele movie, Nope, which is starring Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer. I don't think we really know anything about it, but it's Jordan Peele and it's that cast. So yes to Nope. And then I'm also excited for the new Pixar movie, Turning Red, which the trailer's already dropped for the first trailer, but it's about a young girl who turns into a giant red panda whenever she gets like really out of control in terms of her emotions. So it looks like it could be another like really interesting, fun Pixar movie. So those are the two I'm like most looking forward to so far.
We have been talking with NPR's Aisha Harris about some of her favorites of the past year's movies and a couple she's looking forward to. Again, you can see Aisha's entire list by going to hereandnow.org. Aisha, thanks so much.
Thank you. I'm talking.
And this is music from another of Aisha's favorites, Sly and the Family Stone, performing Sing a Simple Song from Summer of Soul.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
As this year comes to a close, we're taking some time to remember some of the 800,000 people who have died of COVID-19 in our country. Victoria Madrid shared this memory of her father, Eric, who died of COVID on January 11th. He worked at a dive bar called Johnny's in Los Angeles's neighborhood of Highland Park. His friends and loved ones said his daughter was his whole world. Here's Victoria.
He spoiled me with his time. He would take me everywhere. I'd go on adventures with him. That's what I'd call it. He'd bring things home for me. It could be something he found that he thought was cool. It was like a new toy, something I could play with my dad. He would be like a horse sometimes. And this, like he'd go on like all fours, like on the carpet and like walk around. And I'd be like, yeah. And he'd go. And like, I look at it now and I'm like, that's ridiculous, but it was fun. Like, I didn't have to go to Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm. I could go to the park with him and it was fine. He went to the Selena Gomez concert with me though. The Selena Gomez concert was like the first concert I had ever gone to. He held this sign that I made that said, I heart Sell, because I couldn't spell Selena Gomez because it was too small. It had lights and everything, so there's this man just carrying around this neon sign. I think just like seeing me happy was good for him. He liked seeing me happy.
That's Victoria Madrid talking to member station KCRW about her father, Eric, who died of COVID earlier this year. He was 50 years old. Dreema Ellen Slack also died of COVID in January. Her granddaughter, Marissa Yingling, shared this tribute for NPR's series, Songs of Remembrance.
I lost my gran, who was 85 years old, and her name was Dreema Slack. The song that reminds me of her, although there are several, is Sunshine on My Shoulders by John Denver.
Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy.
For her, I think that The sunshine Denver talks about in the song is really a metaphor for these small joys, for reading books to her granddaughters, which was one of her favorite things to do, skiing with her son on the mountains in West Virginia, dancing with her husband or sharing a meal with friends.
Sunshine on the water looks so lovely.
So my grandmother would sing this song to me on numerous occasions when we were just out on a Saturday afternoon riding bikes, or when we were eating Ellen's ice cream on Capitol Street in Charleston.
If I had a day that I could give you.
And we have an interactive map with more of our COVID remembrances at hereandnow.org.
A day just like today. And if I had a song that I could sing.
It's been a painful ride during the COVID-19 pandemic for the world's travel and tourism industry. The holidays typically gives the airlines a boost, but the pandemic, of course, is not over. And the global travel sector is expected to lose $2 trillion in revenue just this year. That's according to the United Nations World Tourism Organization. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us now for a look back at this year and to also peek into his crystal ball, so to speak, to help us with what could be in store for 2022 and beyond. Welcome.
Hey, Tanya.
Seth, 2020 was brutal for the airline industry, as we know, with much of the world in various lockdowns. How did things go this year? Were there any bright spots?
Well, if you think things couldn't have been any worse than they were in 2020, you were right. Things were better in 2021. Basically, the pandemic itself has driven travel trends, right? And as things have gotten better at times, things have gotten better for airlines and other travel companies around the world. And then as things have gotten worse, related to the pandemic itself, no surprise, that impacts travel demand. And sometimes it's just people's fears and what people feel comfortable doing. And other times it's closed borders and things like that, mm-hmm. where you just can't travel. So, you know, just as things started looking hopeful over the summer, then you had the Delta variant. And no surprise, that was bad news for airlines, hotels, other travel providers around the world.
Yeah, I mean, talk a little bit more about our behaviors. How have they changed over time? Are more people willing to fly at least domestically versus internationally?
Yeah, and that's where more of the recovery has happened so far. Nothing is back to where it was before the pandemic, but there's sort of a sliding scale. If you could picture domestic leisure travel, include with that what you call VFR travel, visiting friends and relatives, people going to see their families. That's what has rebounded the most, approaching where it used to be. People traveling for holidays and going on leisure trips. Then when you start to get into business travel, a lot less of that, and international travel also, a lot less of that than there used to be. And again, the difference there as compared to domestic travel is that it's not just a question of what we're comfortable with. It's a question of what we're allowed to do. Until not long ago, you couldn't even go to Canada if you wanted to.
That makes sense. And, you know, we're talking about this in regards to airline travel. But for a while, we saw a little bit of a bump in train travel. How has this industry been impacted during this time, specifically for domestic travel?
Yeah, the pandemic hasn't been good for very many travel companies, but clearly the most devastating for airlines. Not good for Amtrak, which has had some of the same kinds of restrictions, you know, masks and so forth, which put some people off, at least. There are people who avoid those kinds of travel arrangements just because they want to be able to do what they want in their own cars. But yeah, on the other hand, because so many more people are traveling domestically, that does sort of consolidate all the trips into domestic travel, and it has pushed up demand for all kinds of short-haul carriers, be they airlines who fly just domestic, an airline like Southwest, for example, has been impacted less than the global airlines. And Amtrak has rebounded from where it was. But the kind of travel that's off the least is private vehicle travel. That's something that is close to where it was before the pandemic.
Man, don't we know it? We know that more folks are on the road now. It feels like pre-pandemic times for sure.
Yep.
You know, one thing we've also learned about ourselves during this time is that we can conduct business virtually. How has that impacted business travel?
Well, it's impacted it in a big way. And of course, there are several trends all kind of rolled into one, Tanya, right? You've got the fact that people are working from home in many cases, which is related to the fact that they're conducting meetings via Zoom and other other methods like that. And yeah, there's no question that there is more than short-term impact, let's say, to say the least, to understate the case, right? Now, the question is over the long term, how things are going to shake out. If you look over the history of the airline industry, there have been all kinds of other technologies that people thought might be the end of air travel, or at least significantly dent it. There was a famous United Airlines commercial from back in the 1980s where people were conducting business by fax so much that they had lost those person-to-person contact.
I got a phone call this morning from one of our oldest customers. He fired us. After 20 years, he fired us. Said he didn't know us anymore. I think I know why. We used to do business with a handshake, face to face. Now it's a phone call and a fax. Get back to you later with another fax, probably. Well, folks, something's got to change.
You know, fax machines didn't kill the airline industry. Early generation video chatting and so forth didn't. But this is the biggest change we've seen, right? This is really something that's happening. Air travel really is down this time, whereas it never really was down because of fax machines. And so we'll have to see over the long term what that means. For as long as people are not back in offices full time, there is going to be less travel, what you call intra-company or inter-office travel, somebody going from Chicago to the New York office because if there's nobody in the office, there's no reason to go there. Conferences, that sort of thing, people do value those person-to-person contacts, but we'll have to see how much of that kind of business migrates permanently online. Some conferences have gone back in person as people have wanted to do that networking and the kinds of things that are best done in person.
You brought up the Omicron variant. I mean, this year, international borders began to open up, but then they made the discovery of the Omicron variant. The U.S. imposed travel bans, as well as other places. Here's how President Biden explained his decision to impose air travel restrictions, specifically to South Africa and seven other countries last month.
The reason for the immediate travel ban is there were a significant number of cases, unlike any other country. Well, there few around South Africa in the world. We needed time to give people an opportunity to say, get that vaccination now before it heads. It's going to move around the world. I think it's almost inevitable there will be at some point that strain here in the United States.
France also just recently announced restrictions on non-EU citizens traveling from the UK because of Omicron, which is a big deal. How disruptive can we expect next year to be, knowing that we're all in this moment where Omicron is spreading really fast?
Yeah, Omicron, and then who knows what the next variant might be. This just, if anything, sort of reinforces the nature of this pandemic and how unpredictable it is. And just when you think that you're turning the corner, who knows? It's on people's minds as they book travel, right? Somebody who is considering traveling to places that now are largely off limits because of Omicron. And it's raised some other issues. You mentioned Southern Africa, Tanya, right? There are cultural issues that have bubbled up here, too. You heard what President Biden said there. He's not the only world leader in the developed world in particular who made comments like that. And you have a leader like the president of Malawi who said on Facebook, I want to read you this quote, COVID measures must be based on science, not Afrophobia. He was making the point that those nations down in Southern Africa felt like they were singled out. South Africa was scientists there were the first to come out and identify Omicron and kind of warn the world. And then they were dented economically by the ban. So that's something that governments are going to have to continue weighing here, what they see as the science alongside other important considerations.
You know, this time last year, we were talking bailouts for the airline industry. Now we're talking about the future of the airline industry. We have not seen major changes since 9/11. How do you think the pandemic is going to shift and change the way we travel and how this might impact airlines specifically as we go into 2022?
Well, anytime you have one of those major events, and let's be honest, they're usually bad things, right? You mentioned 9/11, one of those shocks to the world travel system. You're going to have major changes. For now, we have masks on board, of course, mandatory masking and those kinds of changes, the sanitation and all of that. But over the longer term, yeah, let's see if people change their choices about travel. Ecotourism, green travel, as it's sometimes called, people looking for sustainable vacations where they have less of a carbon footprint. Now, that's not a new idea that existed before the pandemic, but because the pandemic has kind of shaken up everybody's routines anyway, it kind of gives people a chance to rethink all of that. So let's see if those trends catch on more than in the past.
Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Don't we all need just a bit of good news these days? Maybe it's that feeling of seeing something beautiful that we've never seen before. Well, for bird aficionados in New England, they've certainly found it. A rare Steller's eagle was spotted this week along the Tonantin River in Massachusetts, with white patches on its wings and a large yellow beak.
People dream of seeing this bird. It's such an impressive, huge raptor.
Nick Lund is with the Maine Audubon Society and runs a blog called The Birdist. He drove hours to see the Steller's eagle, which can weigh 20 pounds and boast a wingspan of 8 feet, significantly larger than bald eagles. And just how rare are they?
Rarity means a lot of different things. They are rare even in their native range of Siberia and sort of northern Japan.
Lund says it's almost unheard of to find Steller's eagles in the United States, with only about 4,000 left in the entire world. And for Lund, that scarcity makes the bird that much more special.
To have that show up in our backyards is just such a delight, such an unexpected treat. It's really fun.
This Steller's eagle has since taken flight, and no one knows yet where it's headed. It was previously spotted in Texas, then in Quebec, and the Maritimes in Canada. But we at Here and Now hope you'll take just a moment to gaze into the sky or onto the limbs of trees. You might just be the one to spot this majestic bird next, wherever its journey takes it. Now for some Christmas magic. We see it in holiday movies and read about it in books like The Night Before Christmas. But we all have the ability to weave magic if we choose to. Katie Sewell of the Bittersweet Life podcast tells us about a holiday mystery from long ago.
I've kept a secret for over 30 years, but that ends today. It started in middle school, 8th grade. Christmas was right around the corner, and that's when I first noticed Jeremy.
When I arrived at school, I was really shy and, you know, just going through the motions of school.
I didn't know it then, but when Jeremy moved to my school, it was because his mother had just died.
My dad was suffering and mourning, really broken up and dysfunctional. And he mourned his whole life.
I saw him in the halls. We had classes together. I knew he was new, and I knew he seemed alone. And I wanted to do something about that. Not just be nice to him at school, which I was. Something bigger. Something magic. So I hatched a plan. To make it work, I needed his address. A getaway driver, some money, and the cover of darkness. And I needed my friend Rachel as an accomplice. And she went along with the plan.
I'm very easygoing. And like all the crazy stuff you'd pull me into, it was just fun.
On December 1st, we go to his house.
It was one night right after dinner. There was a strange knocking at our door. And I went to the door.
And we leave something on the doorstep.
And I opened it up, and there was a Christmas tree.
Rachel and I go running down the driveway to the street.
A very small Christmas tree. It was about 2 feet tall, and it was beautifully decorated, and it said it was to me from the Christmas elves.
We jump in the getaway car.
I was like, what? What could this be? This is amazing. This is exciting. And I could not figure out who did it, and I ran outside. I looked down the road both directions, and there was no one in sight.
We are long gone.
And throughout that Christmas, it happened again.
We did this every night for 24 straight days, all the way to Christmas.
I remember one time we almost got caught. It was high stakes. Like the magic would be gone.
Jeremy got faster and faster at answering the door. But still, After all those nights, after all those gifts, he never saw us. And we wanted it that way. It seemed like if he never knew it was us, he'd have to suspect the whole school. Somewhere within it, someone was happy he was there. Or maybe it would just feel like magic. After many, many years, I caught up with Jeremy again.
Hi.
Hey. How's it going? Good to see you.
Can I give you a hug?
Oh, there's my puppy.
Oh, hey, buddy.
Oh, hi, puppy.
And I had a gift for him.
Oh, wow. Yes. Oh, my favorite. Thank you so much.
I gave him a Christmas candy cane and told him that all those gifts from long ago, they were from me. The one bad thing about keeping this a secret for 30 years is I never knew if the mystery had mattered to Jeremy. Had it made a difference at all?
That was my first Christmas on Mercer Island, so it was a huge deal. Felt like that was welcoming, and that helped out a lot, and that made Christmas way better. And it was exciting and something to talk about, but the Christmas elves came, and when they come, be ready.
What do you make of that?
Well, I believe people were trying to help me out and make me feel jolly around Christmas and happy and fill in the gaps and the voids that I expressed during the day. But I also believe in magic, and people make magic as well. It was important, super important.
For Here and Now, I'm Katie Sewell.
Katie's story was produced with Casey Martin, with musical help from Adam Scone and the Scone Cash Players. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now.